We will call to order the Tuesday, April 5th meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. And our first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from March 29th. Representative Albright, have you had a chance to review the minutes, sir?
And Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to approve the minutes for the March 29th meeting of the commission.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Any corrections, additions to that set of minutes? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Our second item this evening is a technical correction amendment that we're going to be looking at, and Ms. Barth will walk us through that. And if I'm not mistaken, this has to do with some clarifying language of some things that have occurred in statute from some changes that we've done. So what I'm going to ask her to do is to background us and walk us through that. Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yes, this is a purely technical amendment, and we collaborated with both TRA and St. Paul Teachers to remove obsolete references to the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Association, which is merged with TRA. So we kind of went through both TRA and St. Paul Teachers statutes and took out any sort of obsolete reference that we found.
Members, questions on the A2 amendment. Cleaning up language from the statute on previous actions of the legislature. But I will move the 2807-A2 amendment to be included in the 2016 Pensions Omnibus Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Ms. Barth, you also have the 2807-A4 amendment as well. You'd like to go through that with us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this will amend House File 2784, which is dealing with the increases of the lump sum maximums for all volunteer firefighter relief associations in the state, and then also has that Section 2 dealing with just the Eden Prairie firefighter vesting requirements. So this amendment will deal with Section 1, which is the maximum lump sum provision, and this will allow only Eden Prairie Relief Association to increase their lump sum maximum upon local approval rather than January 1st, 2017, like all other relief associations if they were to increase their maximums. And this was just kind of based on some of the information that I received. The State Auditor's Office, when I spoke to them, is fine with the new effective date so long as it only applies to Eden Prairie. And from what I've been told, no other relief associations are looking for a earlier effective date.
Thank you, Ms. Barth. Members, questions on this? Again, in the way of backgrounding, you recall that Eden Prairie came forward with some things that they have a special provision in statute that governs their fire relief association, and we did some modifying on that to include other departments in the state of Minnesota and their relief associations, but we did not deal with a technical issue, and so that's what this amendment is looking to do. Member questions? Is there anyone from the public who wishes to speak on this matter? Seeing none and hearing none, I will move that House File 2807-4A amendment be added to the 2016 Pensions Omnibus Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Members, I'm going to do one slight deviation from our agenda because item 4 and number 5 are kind of related, where we've been working throughout this session with constituent-related issues and kind of some missteps and mishaps along the way. What I'd like to do is I'd like to drop down to item number 7, which is a bill that is, again, some what I will call some housekeeping kinds of things, and I wanted to bring it forward for our consideration. And if you recall earlier in the session, even before session began, we had a situation where one of our members brought forward an idea, and we had some folks in from EPOC to talk about, and Senator Thompson brought that forward, and we had a discussion with them about some possibilities of some things that we could look at to do some long-term sustainability for our various pension plans. As a result of that, one of the things that we would need to do would be to modify statute to allow for those bequeaths and bequests and for insurance proceeds to be accepted by the state of Minnesota and its respective pension plans to be able to have those as valid sources of funds. Because right now, statute is quiet on some of the plans. There's also information in some of the other plans that would allow for various types of things. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Ms. Lincheski if she will do a little bit of background on this, as we have, she's been involved in kind of looking at the situation and crafting it to be able to, again, put the enabling legislation in if and when we do get to a time where we would be getting those kinds of bequeaths and bequests or an EPIC type of situation. So with that, Ms. Lincheski.
So the bill is very simple. It just authorizes the plans, all of the public pension plans in the state, to accept all of these forms of payment. So these would be gifts, donations, bequests, life insurance, death benefits, and then including life insurance, death benefits that are pursuant to a life insurance premium financing arrangement. So that is sort of a reference to the EPOC structure that we heard about last October. Right now, the two of the plans, MSRS General and Parageneral, do permit gifts, donations, and bequests. They are authorized to accept those under Minnesota statutes. TRA does not currently include anything on that in its statutes. And in addition to the plans having that authority, the Minnesota Management and Budget, MMB, is permitted to accept such payments on behalf of the plans and then pay them over to the plans. So what this achieves is some uniformity so that all of the plans can accept these types of payments. It also then expands the list to include life insurance proceeds. This would be a necessary first step if the commission wanted to move forward with an EPOC-type arrangement. So this doesn't actually, you know, put that sort of arrangement in place or really move too far down the path towards putting that in place, but it does take an initial step to allow life insurance proceeds. And then the final issue was that there was a question that was raised by the legal counsel for PARA and MSRS as to whether there was any issue under the federal tax code with respect to qualification of the plan. And based on some research, my opinion would be that we would be okay and would not run afoul of the qualification rules in the tax code.
Members, questions for Ms. Lincheski or the bill's author, which would be me?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lincheski, as I'm looking at the depiction for the types of gifts, whether they be online 1.11 through 1.13 specifically, I'm just wondering if there is a need for greater specificity with regard to liquid versus illiquid investments or real property as construed or personal property. I don't know that any plan wants to get into the habit of accepting those items that might be necessarily difficult to liquidate or to turn into investable assets.
Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think is a worthwhile comment. I think that is true that the plans would not want to accept something that was not liquid. I would note that the provisions in the statute that allow MMB to accept these types of payments would allow for that kind of illiquid sort of donation or gift. And then MMB, there are statutes that authorize them to take whatever actions are necessary to liquidate that kind of property and then turn over the proceeds to the plans. So I'm thinking we could further refine this, or we could sort of just allow what would probably naturally happen, which was that the plan would work with MMB to get the property, you know, into liquid form and then have it be paid over.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Lincheski, I think it also goes to the point in terms of, from an appraisal perspective, marking to the market the valuation process for some of the gifts and bequests that might, you know, come into a pension plan. I guess I'm presuming that the section that you cite in the bill clarifies that. But just to put on the record that I think that's just a good procedural prudence from a fiduciary's perspective that we honor that liquidity and marking to the market appraisal value.
Ms. Lincheski, follow-up?
No follow-up,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Members, other questions? Anyone from the public that wishes to testify on House File 3805? Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I just can't quite wrap my head around this. What are we trying to accomplish with this? What are you trying to accomplish with this?
Very good question, Senator Pappas. Couple of things. Number one, some of the plans currently can take some of the things that we see listed here. Others can't. So I'm trying to, first of all, make all of the plans on the same level and playing field with those kinds of things. Number two, we have, over the time that I've been involved in the Pension Commission, we've had different constituency groups that maybe retired or active workers and different things that have wanted to come before the commission and have a sense of dedication to their profession and want to see the pensions continue to go. So we might have had a situation where someone who upon their death has done some estate planning and said, you know what, I want to make sure that teachers in the future have money in their pension plan, and I'm going to take a part of my estate at $50,000, $5,000. I'm going to donate it to the pension fund to help with that. Well, right now, we don't have a vehicle in which to take those kinds of things in some of our pensions. Or if I had a life insurance policy and I left the death benefit to MSRS or to St. Paul Teachers or whoever, there isn't a vehicle in some of these to be able to accept those funds. I'm simply just allowing that to happen if and when it should. And then if we're also going to be in a situation where we would get into the EPOC, because that deals with insurance proceeds and payments from insurance, that this would also cover that as well. That's the pure, simple part of the idea of and the genesis behind it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
It seems kind of unlikely to me that, but you never know. I suppose it doesn't hurt. You know, I don't really see any downside to doing it, so.
Senator Pappas, I thought the same thing, and that's why I waited till kind of the end. It's like, do I want to do something like this? Because it is one of those things where you go, how often is that going to happen? Mm-hmm. But as I've been kidding with some of the plan directors, and why we're looking at doing this is if you get a check, you have to put it in the drawer for 6 months until the legislature gets together to allow you to be able to take that money.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this does is this says, hey, you can go ahead and cash the check because it's an acceptable form of payment or contribution. And we've all seen in the news and different things where weirder things than that have happened, where someone's left money who we thought was, you know, not well to do, and all of a sudden they leave like college or university or some other charity a rather sizable sum of money. We're right. Simply just looking at that as an option.
Okay.
I don't think, I'm not asking for a fiscal note or a fiscal committee to look at this to go out campaign for these kinds of things, but nonetheless, it's still one of those things where we might be able to at least set the stage for that if someone would be so inclined.
All right, I got it.
Representative Murphy.
But is there anything in here that would prohibit a plan or a commission to take out like a life insurance policy on someone or something?
Representative Murphy, I will answer that. That is not the that is not allowed in this piece of legislation. It would take additional legislative action to allow for something for that to happen. The EPOC kind of idea or others, we are so far away from being able to be structurally set to do something like that. This is just building the base for what you see here in this bill allows for that to happen, plus a whole lot of other things that we've been talking about. Death benefit on a life insurance policy that someone says, I want to leave it to a plan or I want to leave it to one of those funds, we would now legally be able to accept that, where previously in statute it says can come from an employer, comes from an employee in some of our language. Well, neither one of those was an employer or an employee contribution through payroll or other deduction. So it just allows for some of that flexibility. May we never use it? Who knows? But at least we've got it if the situation ever arises. Representative Murphy, follow-up?
Yes. you know, Mr. Chair, our individual bills, sometimes they get, people think they could then. So could one of those people say, that something could be the employer's share or the employee's share to cover their individual situation, that when they have to pay back $150,000 or something, could they use a money from a gift or a donation or a bequest or life insurance for that purpose, for their own buyback?
I'm going to defer that to Representative Albright.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Representative Murphy, I believe that when you're dealing with a gift, whether it is to an individual or to an entity, it is irrevocable. And as such, the recipient of that gift can determine to the extent that it is used without any encumbrances made on it by the grantor of the gift. And so as such, the person making the gift would not be able to direct the placement of that gift in a specific line item to offset any debt owed to them or that they owe to the plan.
Other member questions? Anyone from the public wishing to step forward to testify in the matter before the commission? Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Schertz, welcome. Mr. Bergstrom, I'll ask you to go ahead and identify yourself, and then we'll hear your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thanks. My name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I just have a couple of things to raise. First of all, in the list, in MSRS law, we already can accept gifts, donations, and bequests. Those are specifically included in our law. So the only thing that is added here is the life insurance benefit and the other similar sources of funding. I listened to the EPOC proposal. I heard a lot of questions. I still have a lot of concerns that need to be addressed. And I'm a little concerned if you put that in statute, the pressure to add types of things. I just think it needs a lot more study to do it. Also concerned
Mr.
about...
Mr. Bergstrom, just to clarify, we're not talking about EPOC. We're just talking about proceeds from a life insurance. This is not EPOC legislation.
Mr. Chair, would it allow for an EPOC type of investment? I thought I heard that it would.
Mr. Bergstrom, it would allow for, if we ever got to that level, the words here, insurance proceeds, which is what that would be acceptable. It would be the kind of the hand and the glove on that. We still got to get the hand with the fingers and everything else squared away before we can put the hand in the glove.
So, Mr. Chair, could, without legislation, could that investment be offered?
No. Okay. To my understanding, Ms. Lincheski, I'll defer to her, but that's my understanding, is that we could not offer the EPOC type of program without further additional legislative authority and approval. Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm listed out some of the concerns that we had after looking at the materials. Probably the number one item is this insurable interest concern. I can't see, based on my review, that the EPOC situation would work under our laws currently as it relates to insurable interest and possibly the stranger-owned life insurance. So at a minimum, and I think there's more issues, too, to be resolved with other parts of the statute, including federal law, I think at a minimum our insurance statutes would have to be amended.
Mr. Bergstrom, one thing that I would point out is you've indicated that MSRS can currently accept, and I may be off on this, but gifts, donations, and bequests. None of those would fall into the category of death benefits paid out on a life insurance policy by definition. So it would allow for that, and that is my thoughts, is how it would be used right now without the additional enabling legislation to do the EPOC kind of idea, which the commission clearly, and you've expressed as well, have some additional questions and things that need to be looked at.
Okay, Mr. Chair, so that helps clarify, and I wasn't sure if this would allow it. And then item number five, other similar sources of funding. That's fairly vague, and I think would leave itself to creative. Do you have any idea what that would be?
I'll ask the person who helped me draft that what her thoughts were on that. Ms. Linchowski.
Mr. Chair, I was somewhat going off of the statutes MSRS and PARA, which adds in or otherwise at the end of each of those, and sort of an extension of that concept, which is we can't anticipate every sure. possible type of payment that could come in. So that was the logic behind it.
And Mr. Chair, I think just from a technical standpoint, I think you'd want to repeal that language in our law because it might be some different wording. So just a thought, because we have similar language, but if you do move ahead with this, and you know, I would like to think that would be something to clarify.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Ms. Schertz, welcome. State your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jill Schertz, St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association Executive Director. First, thank you very much for the clarification. We appreciate it. St. Paul, as you noted in your staff memo, we do not currently have any of these provisions. From our perspective, we'd certainly welcome items 1 through 3 and would gladly embrace legislation that permitted that. And in fact, we'd be happy to start a campaign to solicit gifts here tonight if you'd like. But we share similar concerns on number 4. It caught our attention as well, simply because I think that when we did hear the presentation, and while this is not drafted with EPIC specifically in mind, the staff memo cited that as the example of why this would be necessary. We walked away from that session with the impression that any type of insurance financing arrangement would be the subject of very extensive study, review, and conversation. And so I guess we were concerned to see any legislation come in this session ahead of that discussion. And it would seem to us that it would be very reasonable if we needed to add the language that says including onward, that adding that could come as a part of that broader discussion about whether we were moving forward. And we'd note that kind of moving towards any premium financing or other arrangement would be a fairly large step and a fairly large change for all of our plans. So we'd welcome tabling that portion of this provision until we all had a chance to study it further.
Thank you, Ms. Schertz. Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, I have no further comments.
Members, I have no problem with taking and laying this bill over. I wanted to bring it forward since we did have some discussion. And I would offer this for folks if they feel a little bit more comfortable about this, taking items 1, 2, and 3, and then an item 4, deleting everything from the comma all the way through item number 5. I'm fine with that. It's just life insurance death benefits, which then ties it to someone who has named a particular plan if that's their desire as the beneficiary. I have my ideas. I wanted to open this up for those since some had it, some didn't. And clearly we're not ready to do the EPOC idea when we just keep referring it to as such. And I'm fine with that if that helps with members getting some comfort on that. Again, we were just looking at this globally. Discussion to that?
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Your proposal is to delete line 1.14 through 1.17?
Not all of line 1.14. Everything from the comma to the end of that section. So it would still say life insurance death benefits period. So,
but delete the rest of this.
Right.
Sentence.
So if I had so chosen on a life insurance policy to name St. Paul Teachers mm-hmm. as a beneficiary, they would legally be able to accept that because it doesn't fall into a gift, donation, or bequest.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chairman, and follow up.
And then also item or line 1.17 as well.
To delete that as
yes.
Well. Oh, because I was about to ask, what
yep.
does that mean?
So I will actually move that as the amendment to the the House File 3805 to delete from the comma all the way through line, the comma in line 1.14 all the way through line 1.17. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. I just don't know how that substantively changes the language, because when it says life insurance benefits, including these kinds of benefits, if you're still including life insurance death benefits, you'd be including those kind of you'd still be including those kind of life insurance benefits. So I don't know that it's actually the amendment does anything if people have concerns about those types of benefits.
Unless you say not including.
But there is no enabling legislation, Representative Thiessen, to allow for an EPOC type of situation, which we would need to have anyhow. And again, I'm just
trying to imagine someone leaving.
I'm not going to the Hill on this one, folks. I'm just offering it because we did have some discussion over the session on it, and getting a chance to take a peek at that. So, does the amended language provide comfort for people? And again, I'm happy to pull this. I just wanted to bring it forward. I don't mean for this to be our toughest discussion thus far this session. Representative Albright.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, and this is just advice to the Chair, but as I consider gifts, and it certainly is the opportunity for a beneficiary to decline a gift in as much as they are capable of accepting it, I don't see that there is that opportunity in the operative language above that we're talking about. And I'm looking at the section of statute here, and just from my own perspective, I don't see, and it may not be codified, but the plans may have protocols in place in terms of how they would turn that into investable cash or a liquid asset. But in light of that, Mr. Chair, my advice, and with your indulgence, is if you would just possibly lay this over for further consideration, given some of the questions that we've raised and as a consideration for future enactment.
And again, as I said, I have no problem doing that. And since we haven't moved the oral amendment at this point, we can certainly lay it over, and that's what I'm happy to do, is just lay over 3805 for future consideration. But it is something that we had kind of talked about, and I wanted to piece it together. And I'm happy to do that. Just wanted to try to help with something that I thought we might be taking a peek at on here. Now what we will do is we'll go back to item number 4, and I will invite Representative Earhart to come forward. He has a bill that will be before us, and that will be House File 3606, and it has to do with another one of the corrections or proposed corrections where there may have been an error in determining someone's eligibility for benefits. And members, so that you're also aware, we do have item 5, which is our consideration this session of all of the things that we have heard that we've been laying over for possible inclusion. So I would like to take those matters up this evening. And hearing item 4, you'll notice that in 5A is included in that, the Earhart bill, if that is something that the commission wants to address this evening for possible inclusion as well. So we will be taking action on item 5 this evening, and we'll do as we've done in the past, and I'll get closer to that when we get there. Representative Earhart, welcome to the Pension Commission, and I'd ask you to go ahead and state your name for the record and then introduce your bill to us.
Representative Ron Earhart for the record, and good evening, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill is about the man to my right, Daniel Allness, who served as a security caseworker from May 1986 to September 1989 and contributed to the MSRS general plan. However, in September of 1989, he moved into a position covered by the MSRS correctional plan. When the security caseworkers were removed from the MSRS general plan to the correctional plan in 1986, he should have been offered the ability to switch the service to the correctional plan. MSRS verified that he should have been able to switch the service, but the Department of Corrections never certified that he was eligible to switch the time. And at this point, the only remedy appears to be special legislation. That is why we're here. And under this legislation, Mr. Allness will pay about $11,000, and the Department of Corrections will pay the difference to cover the full actuary costs of the difference. And Mr. Allness is here to testify. Mr. Allness.
Mr. Allness, welcome to the committee, and I would ask you to go ahead and state your name and your testimony, and then we'll see if members have questions, and we'll go from there. Again, good evening and welcome.
My name is Dan Allness. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak this evening. I started with the Department of Corrections while I was going to college. I started at the St. Cloud Prison in 1981. When I graduated with dual majors in criminal justice studies and psychology with a counseling emphasis. When I graduated, it was about the same time that the Oak Park Heights Maximum Security Prison was opening up. I transferred to Oak Park Heights in Stillwater, Minnesota, where I was fortunate to get some promotions. I was sergeant of the Institution Security Squad. It's basically the emergency response team. In the late 80s, based on institution needs, I took a job as a corrections security caseworker. And when I took that job, I moved from the correctional retirement plan to the general plan. In this job as a security caseworker, I had contact with inmates probably 90% of my work time. My office was in the living units with the inmates, office share, that I shared with the security lieutenant. On a daily basis, I provided lunch relief for the security staff for about an hour and a half a day. I pat searched inmates, approximately 50 inmates every day. I responded to emergencies. I responded to some serious staff assaults while I was a caseworker. Stayed late many times working on special security details. So I think, you know, without going into any more detail than that, I think by the state statute, I meet the percentage time requirement in contact with inmates. When I left the casework position, I was promoted to a lieutenant and finished my career as a watch commander, as an institution watch commander, and again, supervisor of the prison's security squad. When I was promoted to a lieutenant and left, I went back into the correctional plan. At no time was I ever offered, informed, advised, or anything about my eligibility, which I met, to buy back that time, that 3.3 years from when I was in the general plan. I did not find out about this eligibility till I was actually in pre-retirement planning approximately 4 years ago. And then I was told that I wasn't eligible because of the expiration date. So that's about all I got. If you have any questions.
Mr. Aulis, thank you. Ms. Lincheski, you have some things that you've prepared as well, and I probably should have gone to you first on this, and my apologies for that, to kind of help do some backgrounding and setting up on what you found in your office when bringing this forward today. So I will give you the opportunity to brief the commission as well. Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have anything to add to the facts. What I understand, Mr. Aulis is relaying to the commission is what I believe tried to put into the memo. The only couple of points I would like to note is that Mr. Aulis did appeal the determination by the executive director that he was not entitled to do the service transfer and make the payment that would allow for that. That decision of the executive director was appealed to the board of MSRS. I understand that that hearing has not occurred and has sort of been put in suspense in order to seek a solution here at the legislature. My only point really in that is that I think the fact finding that could result from that administrative process being sort of worked through might be valuable to the commission, since I think there is maybe a difference of opinion as to some of the facts relating to what he may have been told at the time. I don't have anything to support that, but only know that if there was that fact finding being done with the board, it may produce some additional information. The second item that I just wanted to mention is that the Department of Corrections should speak to this issue. There is a charge to the Department of Corrections of about $33,000, I believe, for this. I understood in talking with them and with the plan that this may be a precedent-setting event and that there may be others that will come in with similar circumstances and will want to have this this opportunity as well, which kind of leads to the issue, perhaps we could look at broader legislation that would provide for this, bring that to the commission, and then the commission could determine whether that's appropriate or not.
Thank you, Ms. Lincheski. Members, questions for Representative Earhart, Ms. Lincheski, or Mr. Allness at this time? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allness, have you brought this to the legislature before?
Mr. Allness.
No, I haven't.
A follow-up, Representative Murphy.
Would you review again what and when you originally found out that you were not eligible for this?
Yes, thank you. I can only approximate the first time I went to the retirement seminar was probably approximately 5 years ago. And during that seminar, when there's representatives from MSRS, Social Security, insurance companies, everything, one of the representatives mentioned that if you were ever in both plans, the correctional and general plan, and if you ever bought time back, and that's the first time that I ever heard about that program or that opportunity, that privilege.
Representative Murphy, follow up.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Allness, for about 15 years, if not 20 years, we've had cases brought by people that were in one plan or in the other plan, or people that were ineligible to be in the correction plan. And then about 10 years ago, maybe, we had a Department of Human Services and Department of Corrections kind of review all the cases, all the situations where people were saying they should be eligible for one or not the other kind of things, and it's worked out pretty well since then because they review all the possible cases or individuals and their retirement. And so I, with your long history, I don't understand how you didn't know that there were confusions about what would count or wouldn't count at a much earlier time.
Representative Murphy, did you want Mr. Allness to respond to that?
Yes.
Mr. Allness.
Thank you. When I was employed with the state of Minnesota, the Department of Corrections, I don't believe that I was ever confused about what program I was in. I was fully aware that I was in the general program, and that's part of the reason that I left that position. That position was a very nice position. It had weekends, holidays off, regular day hours. I left that to go back to shift work, working third watch, working first watch, working second watch, working fully knowing that I was going to be working weekends and holidays for the rest of my career. And I left that so I could be eligible for early retirement. At no time was I ever notified by the union, by middle management, by the administration, and most of all, we would rely on human resources to inform us of programs or privileges that we had, whether it was vacation, sick leave, insurance programs, training, any benefit. I was never notified, so I don't think I was ever under any confusion about what I was doing or what I was going on or what plan that I was in. When I heard about this buyback option, I went to the MSRS people and requested that if I could get in. And they said, nope, it's too late. And it wasn't until my final retirement planning that I asked again. I asked many times. And they said, no, it's too late. And the retirement counselor I had, she said, this isn't right, which brought this whole issue up again. So I hope I answered your question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Allman.
Representative Murphy.
Who was the employment counselor that said this is not right? Who was she employed by?
MSRS.
Mr. Allman. Other member questions for Mr. Allness, because we do have a testifier who would like to come forward, and at this time I'm going to invite the Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Corrections, Lisa Wojcik, if I got that correct, to come. She had asked to testify on the matter before us as well. Good evening, Ms. Wojcik, and welcome to the Commission. If you'd state your name for the record and provide us your testimony this evening.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, my name is Lisa Wojcik. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Operations Support for the Department of Corrections. I agree with Mr. Aldis's assessment of his case. He was a caseworker back in 1986 and was in the general plan at that time. In 1996, that classification of employee were included in the Corrections Employee Retirement Plan, and people were given the option then to buy back time. I cannot verify one way or another for sure if Mr. Allness was notified that he could buy this back. We do not have a paper copy of a letter that may have been sent to him or not sent to him. Typically, what would happen is if an employee did request a buyback service, there was a form that was completed, and our human resource department would verify that they actually worked in that classification and that they had 75% offender contact, which made them eligible for that buyback. So we do not have anything on record, anything in Mr. Allness's file that indicates he did request a buyback during the appropriate time frame. I would say the time frame has expired. We are concerned if this passes that there could be a group of other people out there who did not meet that time frame who would also want to buy back their time. So we are concerned about the precedents it may set.
Ms. Wojcik, just for the Commission's benefit, does the Department of Correction or any other state agency that you're familiar with send out notices to people saying, hey, you've switched jobs, you might want to look at your benefits differently or any of those kinds of things? Is that a standard protocol?
I don't know that that's standard protocol. When people switch jobs, they get a letter from Human Resources that will tell them what their retirement package is now if it changed, will tell them their start date, their wage. Typically, your benefits don't change all that much unless maybe you switch into the managerial plan. I don't know that it tells our employees you really need to check into this stuff. And I don't know that that would have been the case with Mr. Allness anyway, because you know he had been in the Corrections Employee Retirement Plan prior to his case management service and after his case management service. So it was that, you know, that time frame where he was a case manager that he was in the general plan. And I honestly don't know what we did 20 years ago when it comes to how we might have notified an employee when they switch jobs that, you know, you're not in the general plan anymore, now you're in corrections retirement plan.
Members, questions for Ms. Wojcik? Seeing none at this time, I'm going to just have you hang close in case there are some questions that come up. Mr. Bergstrom, as the plan director, and we're talking about MSRS, I'd also like to have you provide some feedback and testimony this evening, too, for the Commission's consideration on this. Mr. Bergstrom, if you'll state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the State Retirement System. So at the time that in 1996, they added caseworkers to the correctional plan, as Representative Murphy knows quite well. At that point, the department certified to us that the people had who were eligible to buy back past service that they had 75% inmate contact. So we received certification from the department that they met the 75% criteria. We then contacted the employees and said, you have to buy back service if you want to do this, and you have until 1999 to do so. So at the time that Mr. Allness retired, he was talking to one of my counselors, and he then, not sure what the counselor said, but at that time, 1999 has long passed. We had no idea if he had 75% inmate contact, because we would have no way of knowing that. So Mr. Allness appealed. At that point, I looked through all of our files. We found no record of any certification that he qualified or met the 75%, so we did not receive any notification. I then contacted the department, and they indicated that, yes, he did have the 75% inmate contact. At that point, with the 1999 deadline well passed, I wrote to him and said, well, I can't help you because 1999, but if you want to appeal to the board. He then appealed to the board. We then set up a fact-finding hearing. I don't think there is a question, at least from what I have heard, that he should have had the opportunity. Now, I don't know about the notification. Going to a fact-finding conference would have left us with 1999 has come and gone, and our attorneys have constantly said, look, if there's a deadline, you can't accept the money. So at that point, I recommended, rather than spending the legal fees, why not see if there's some remedy to this? Because ultimately, you're going to spend money going to a fact-finding conference. They're going to either say to the board, yep, he should have been able to, but the deadline passed, so you can't allow him. Or they're going to say, well, the deadline passed, and you can allow him. And I don't know what that answer would be. But with the 1999 deadline gone, our board has repeatedly been told we can't do that. So I didn't feel there was any remedy for this, even if Mr. Allness was successful. And that's when I recommended at the time, you know, maybe rather than going through that process and the time and everything, that this would be a better alternative if indeed he did. Because our board, I don't believe, will have the authority to resolve this, even if all of the facts played out in his case. It increases his monthly benefit by about $280. He would pay $11,000. The department would pay about $32,000. And Mr. Chair.
Members, questions for Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Do we have any idea if, you know, it sounds like we're setting a precedent here, and do we have any idea how many other employees might also fall into this category?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I would not have the ability to do that because we don't know if they had certified 75% contact. So I am convinced there are probably others in similar situations, but I can't verify that they met the 75% inmate contact.
Senator Goodwin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was lobbying for MAPE at the time that this bill got passed, and we did include caseworkers in it that should have been included and are now included. But we had a pretty solid agreement that we wouldn't go past that deadline. I tried to bring a similar bill forward for a constituent in my district to in 2000 or 2001, which was just past the deadline, and we didn't get that through. So I'm assuming there are others that would have to be, we'd have to go back on. It's a difficult battle, and Representative Mary Murphy was the chair at the time, so we went through her committee, and we had a lot of explaining to do why we would want this. And in fact, we even had the pension director of our commission come to Stillwater and see what the caseworkers did in order to make sure he understood that they did spend an awful lot of time with the inmates. So all I'm saying is there probably are a number of others. I'm sure this isn't the only case like this.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, so what we don't know is, and there appears to be no record, if Mr. Allness was notified of the deadline, that he had until 99 to buy back service. Is that correct? Nobody has any record either way.
Mr. Bergstrom.
We don't know if an error occurred.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we have no record in Mr. Ulmus's case. We do have records of a lot of employees we did notify, but we have nothing specific to Mr. Ulmus.
Mr. Ulmus.
Thank you, sir. After I was at the retirement counseling session at MSRS, I immediately went back to the institution and with one of our HR staff went through every page of my personnel file, because back in the at the time when I switched, and you talk about position descriptions and how the state or how human resources, they always informed by paper copy. There was nothing in there in paper. As to the question of how many other state employees, past or present, are under the same conundrum that I'm under, I think there's very, very few. I can understand how this is a concern to the department and to the state, but I think there's very, very few, because most of these people that were working in that position were ushered right through it. I was one of the forgotten ones because nobody left that job. Everybody kept that job because it was a prize job. I had already left it. But as far as I know, I am the only one. I think I'm the only one that's ever come out of the Department of Corrections that I know of, and I've talked to a lot of people. And in my job as an institution watch commander, I was always in contact with lieutenants from other institutions, and I have never heard this. In my 33 years, 3 months, and 27 days of working with the state, I have never heard this. And as far as any type of documentation, there is nothing. If I would have been offered this 12 or 15 or 18 years ago, whatever, I would have jumped on it. Thank you very much.
Members, other questions for Mr. Ulmus, Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Volchek, or the bill author, Representative Earhart?
Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think in situations where we have kind of clear evidence that the retiree was informed and just failed to act, it's kind of clear that, you know, where our pension agencies or our state agencies aren't culpable or responsible. Here, I think the situation is it's not clear. We don't know if Mr. Ulmus was told. He doesn't remember it. We don't have any record. I'm kind of torn, but it seems to me that we should lean in the favor of the retiree. It's not that much money that we're talking about, the $11,000 that he has to pay, the department has to pay some money. They don't appear to have a record either. That's the importance of, it shows the importance of keeping records on everyone's part. So although I was initially inclined to be opposed to this because I'm concerned about the precedent, I'm kind of leaning in favor now. I'm interested in hearing what other people think.
Is there anyone from the public who feels that they need to weigh in on this, or somebody who hasn't had a chance to be heard on the matter before the commission? Well, Mr. Ulmus, we'll give you the final word if you want to wrap up on your behalf before we undertake our deliberations on all of the matters, including yours this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, thank you, members. I've never been big on blowing my own horn. But if this comes down to a money issue, I will say that over my career, and I have a book in front of me that if anyone wants to look at it, it's full of letters of recognition and commendation from wardens, commissioners, supervisors. They are letters that relate to my emergency response. There's two letters in here that deal with the saving of a person's life, actually two people, one an inmate and one an education teacher. Countless letters on my participation or my actions in major disturbances. So I feel if this is boiled down to a money issue, which I'm contributing money to it, that I have saved the state countless tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in lawsuits and the preservation of state property within the institution I worked. So, again, pardon me for blowing my own horn, but if it boils down to a money issue, I think the state's way ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Alness. And members, we'll now move to item number five. And what I might suggest that we do is maybe work in reverse order from I back to A, which is the item that we just heard, so that we can continue to move forward here with our discussions.
So, Mr. Chairman, you don't want to take a motion on this now? You want to hold off?
We will take it up tonight, but not at this time, because we're going to be considering all of these. I'd like to do H and I first, because there's going to be some additional staff follow-up from our previous discussions. And 5 is, I think, pretty well set for the commission to act on those individually. I take item H. This is something that I think, Senator Pappas, you asked to have separated out from the bill last week, and we've got some additional information. The Senate might have done something with that, and we want to make sure that our language is set up. So I'm going to ask Ms. Lincheski to give us an update on item H for our consideration this evening on the Hometown Heroes discussion. Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is included in your packet is an amendment to the Delete All Amendment, which is our omnibus bill. And this amendment includes the language that Senator Pappas had requested be included in our omnibus bill. It relates only to the portion of this Hometown Heroes Act that relates to PARA. It does make a change from the original bill, and that change is to change the reference to the section to Subdivision 3 of 299A.41, which is the specific subdivision that has the definition of killed in the line of duty. The bill that, as drafted, had included really the entire section of 299A that dealt with these benefits for Hometown Heroes. So that is really the extent of the change here, but so offering up that amendment.
Senator Pappas, did you want to speak to that?
Mr. Chairman, I think we had extensive hearing on this issue. The Hometown Hero Act really is related to emergency responders that are killed in the line of duty, to include even those that maybe have a heart attack in the fire station or something. And it's fairly, it's not very often that it happens, but I think that we shouldn't hold up benefits that can go to the surviving family members. So I would move the 5A amendment be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Senator Pappas moves the 5A amendment to be included in the 2016 pensions omnibus bill. Other discussion by members? Hearing none and seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? We'll take item I, 3136, House file, Senate file, 2853. Ms. Lincheski, if you want to background the commission, and then we'll defer to Representative Thiessen and or Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the very simple change in the statute. This is the statute generally prohibits employers from entering into other pension plan arrangements that are not PARA, TRA, or MSRS, or any of the public pension plans. And it one of the exceptions relates to the Laborers International Union plan. It increases the maximum employer contribution that is permitted to that plan from $5,000 to $7,000. That's really the extent of the change.
Ms. Lincheski, I have just one ministerial question for you on this. On line 2.32, we strike, it begins with the words rate, comma, but not to exceed an employer contribution of $5,000 struck and $7,000 inserted. And then when I go to the top of page 3, line 3.1 and 3.2, I see the exact language there with a 5,000, and then it appears again on line 3.6 and line 3.13. Should those be corrected as well?
That's actually a different exception. So if we're looking at the same copy here, that one relates to the Plumbers and Pipe Fitters National Pension Fund.
Thank you.
So a separate exception. And they haven't
provision,
requested
nine.
That change.
Thank you. I just wanted to get that for clarification. Members, discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this would go to the authors, whether it be Representative Thiessen or Senator Pappas. But I mean, when and how long has the $5,000 figure been in statute?
Ms. Lincheski, are you aware?
I don't know that. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pappas, Representative Thiessen, either of you have background on that?
No, I don't have my file.
I have no idea.
Longer than this session we'll go with.
Well, in light of the change to $7,000, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, since we don't know how long it's been since it was changed to $5,000, and in light of cost of living and inflationary figures, I'm just wondering if the $7,000 figure is a preemptive cap. And maybe more to the point, the question is, what was the determination that $7,000 was the appropriate figure?
Senator Pappas, Representative Thiessen, do either of you have the input on that?
The number, the whole genesis of this legislation is because this plan is under a federal, is trying to get itself out of federal, under federal law to kind of get itself whole again. And the 7,000 number allows them to get the kind of contributions which are coming from the employees, ultimately, to satisfy their federal obligations so that they can participate in that program. And so the 7,000 number kind of solves the problem that they have right now.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
And as Representative Thiessen reminds me, this really comes through from the employer, but through the employee. So an amount is deducted from the employee to pay this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just in light of the annual individual deferral amount, if we're talking about just vernacular for a second, I'm just wondering, for the benefit of, we make the plan sufficient at $7,000 for now, but is there a beneficial means to move the margin higher to avail the plans to have a little more margin on their actuarial calculation in years to come?
We may have some help with your question, Representative Albright. Good evening. I know that you're closely associated with this. If you want to go ahead and identify yourself for the record and attempt to answer Representative Albright's question.
Yeah. Russell Hess, political coordinator for the Laborers District Council of Minnesota and North Dakota. Excuse me. The answer to the first question of when was it last changed, it was last changed from $2,000 to $5,000 in 2006.
Mr. Hess, was that made,
Representative Albright,
in lieu of a similar circumstance to attempt to make the plan sufficient with that number in mind, the 5,000?
Mr. Hess.
Mr. Chair, I believe at that time probably, which way predates my work with the labor union, but I believe then it was just to allow a larger contribution negotiated. The 5,000 is probably a little bit more than we need. But we hit the $5,000 limit in 2018 for at least one of the bargaining units, and the plan is on an upslope now, coming out of the red zone. We're just trying to be safe, so we didn't have to come back in a year or two and do it again.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Hess, going from 2 to 5 is a much larger jump, and I understand the years, but sufficiency being in just a couple more years with a $7,000 bump, is it? Would it be your prerogative to move it higher in lieu of knowing that you've got more margin, or is $7,000 going to take care of you for the next 20 years?
Mr. Hess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I'd say $7,000 is going to be good.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, then I'm satisfied with the answers.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, then I would move that House File 3136 be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Senator Pappas moves that House File 3136, Senate File 2853, be included in the 2016 omnibus pensions bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Continuing up, item G, Ms. Barth, if you want to, well, first of all, members, you do have some paperwork in front of you. If you look at the purple sheet, staff is good enough to be able to do a summary on that, and each of the things that we've heard and laid over for possible inclusion. And so what I'm going to do is ask Ms. Barth to take a look at item G, which is House File 3718, Senate File 3366, and remind the Commission as to what we saw in this issue for our consideration for inclusion. Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 3718 permits, this was discussed last week, it permits those two women, Ms. Randall and Ms. Olson, to elect retroactive and prospective TRA retirement coverage instead of their current MNSCU IRAP coverage, and this is due to MNSCU's failure to provide them with a retirement option election when they reach tenure to elect TRA.
Members, questions or discussion to Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that House File 3718, Senate File 3366 be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Senator Pappas moves House File 3718, Senate File 3366 to be included in the 2016 omnibus pension bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Item F, Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A similar situation. It would allow Ms. LeBlanc, who currently works at St. Cloud State University, to elect retroactive and prospective TRA coverage for her MNSCU employment and repay a previous PAR refund, and this was due because MNSCU did not provide her with an election.
Sorry, Ms. Barth. Ms. Mm-hmm. Barth, thank you. Members, questions on House File 3422? Senator Pappas?
Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 3422, no Senate file number, be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Senator Pappas moves House File 3422 to be included in the 2016 omnibus pension bill. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Item E, Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, a similar situation. This permits Ms. Dene to purchase 5 years of PARA general service credit for when she was erroneously placed in the MNSCU IRAP plan.
Members, questions for Ms. Barth or to the issue? Senator Saxhog.
Mr. Chair, I move House File 3351 and Senate File 2819.
Senator Saxhog moves House File 3351 and Senate File 2890 to be included in the 2016 Omnibus Pension Bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Ms. Barth, you're on a roll. House File 2560.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would allow Mr. Farber to rescind his decision to receive a retirement annuity that he began to receive on January 1st, 2009 from the PARA P&F plan, and instead receive a duty disability benefit that would be retroactive to January 1st, 2009.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I oppose this bill because the reasons here are very good. It's true that there was a lack of evidence that it prevented job performance since he had jobs after that. The cost of the city of Fridley would be well over $200,000, they expect, and it would set a precedent that hasn't been established before. So I hope that we would reject this bill.
Other member discussion? Anyone wishing to move that for inclusion? Seeing none and hearing none, we will not be including House File 2560. The next item that we have is Revisor 15-3939. Ms. Barth, once again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill would allow Susan Rumka to purchase service credit from MSRS General for the 4 months that she was an intern for the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and that was a position that was not eligible for retirement coverage, and it would, if she was allowed to buy this, she would be eligible for the Rule of 90.
Members, discussion to 15-3939 revisor number. Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, once again, I would oppose this because there is no evidence of an error and there is no precedent set for this already, so there would be probably a number of former interns that are now hired on that would be eligible for this.
Any other discussion to Visor 15-3939? Seeing no one moving that for inclusion, we will not be including that. Ms. Barth, House File 1919, Senate File 1972.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is the situation with the five current state employees who would like to purchase service credit from MSRS General for the 2 months that they were trainees and for the Department of Corrections and were, as trainees, ineligible for retirement coverage. And if they were able to purchase their time as trainees, they would be eligible for the Rule of 90.
Members, discussion and questions on House File 1919, Senate File 1972. Anyone wishing to move that for inclusion based on our findings? Seeing none, we will not be including House File 1919, Senate File 1972. And that brings us back then to the case that we heard this evening, House File 3606. Ms. Lincheski, if you want to, although it's pretty recent history, if you want to just give us a summary since that's what we've been doing, and then member discussion. Ms. Lincheski.
As we just heard, this is a situation where the individual should have been given notice or actually should have been certified to MSRS that he was eligible to receive credit for service under the correctional plan and is now requesting a legislative solution to having been missed and then not having this additional benefit under the correctional plan.
Members, discussion to House File 3606. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that based on the fact that there's still an appeal ongoing, it would be best for us to wait at this moment.
Representative Anderson, not to prejudice the other members, that is exactly what I was thinking. If there's a pending appeal, we usually want to take it in the order of protocol on that, and I would look to that. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, that's what it says in the notes, but Mr. Bergstrom indicated that I'm confused about that because I think he indicated that there may be an appeal, but he doesn't see any way it would be approved.
Mr. Bergstrom, if you'd like to come down and provide clarification for the consideration of the commission, that would be appreciated.
Because of a limit, statute of limitation or something, 1999 limit.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, the law only allowed the purchase to 1999.
Right.
So I don't see how the board can remedy this, nor so that's the only concern.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think it's up to us to just decide if we want to do this or not, because I think Mr. Allness really has no other opportunity, no other option. I was inclined to agree with you until Mr. Bergstrom, he repeated his testimony right now. So for purposes of discussion, maybe we might want to discuss it some more. I would move that House File 3606 be recommended to be incorporated in the omnibus bill.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask Mr. Bergstrom to come back down, please.
He's on his way. Mr. Bergstrom, you'll identify yourself, and
Mr.
then
Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Dave Bergstrom, the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System.
Thank you, and I apologize for making you come back and forth like that.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Bergstrom, I'm just curious, how many times do we come across where we can't find the paperwork if we're dealing with issues back to the 80s?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's sometimes hard to recreate history. I would tell you we have a very large file of people we did notify.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
And Mr. Bergstrom, what kind of liability do we open ourselves up to if we set the precedence of if we can't find the paperwork, we're going to go ahead and do this?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in this case, the cost to the state is about $32,000. And it's limited on this case. If others come in and claim they too didn't get it, that could set a precedent for those. But this specific case is about $31,000, $32,000.
So do we have a ball?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bergstrom, do we have any ballpark figure beyond this, kind of setting the stage of other people that might come forward? But I suppose you don't know because you don't have the paperwork.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, they were never certified.
Mr.
So
Bergstrom.
The department has to tell us who was eligible or we can't notify them.
Right.
So our records wouldn't even be able to tell you if they were eligible or not, or how many others may be in a similar situation.
And Representative Anderson. Mr. Chair, I'm really concerned. I think that we'd be getting ourselves down a slippery slope on this situation, and without having that paperwork either from the department or through Mr. Bergstrom, I just don't know if this is really the right thing. Maybe we can look at it at another time where we have a little bit more time to process it.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Just one more attempt. I think the woman from the Department of Corrections, is she still here, Ms. Wojcik?
She is.
Because they didn't have anything in their files as well, right? I mean, they should have some. If they sent the notice to the constituent, they should have a copy of the notice. If they didn't send the notice, then they wouldn't have a copy of it.
Ms. Wojcik, if you'll just identify yourself and then proceed to answer Senator Pappas' question or other information that will help us in the decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lisa Wojcik, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Corrections. Senator Pappas, you're correct. If we would have sent up the notification, I believe the letter would have been in his personnel file.
Mm-hmm.
We do have other cases where we did have the certification form in their files when they requested the buyback. But again, that was 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and we don't know if it was a filing error, if he wasn't notified. We don't know for sure.
Then,
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Wojcik, is the department contesting the $33,000 or what?
Ms. Wojcik.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, we are not contesting the cost of it. We're concerned about the precedent it may set if others come forward and say they did not get notified either, and if the letter isn't in their file, perhaps. We now have a electronic system,
mm-hmm.
but back in 1996, it was all paper records. And again, things can get misfiled, so we don't know for sure if he was notified or not.
Other member questions for
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
And Mr. Bergstrom, you alluded to the fact that the outcome of an appeal would be inconclusive?
Mr. Chair, I believe
Mr.
the
Bergstrom.
Outcome, Representative Albright, I think the outcome of the appeal is 1999 deadline has passed. And there is, the board has repeatedly been told they can't waive deadlines.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Berg,
Representative Albright.
Then, does Mr. Allness still have the opportunity to appeal the decision of the MSRS still before this commission might undertake a decision based upon that outcome from an appeal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright,
Mr. Bergstrom.
He has appealed. We will continue with it going through the process. I'm fairly confident of the outcome, but we certainly can continue with that process as well.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Albright.
It would be, I guess, my opinion that in order to render a decision on this one, you would want to have as robust a collection of facts at your disposal to make a decision. I think it would be in the best interest of this commission to wait for the appeals process to complete itself.
Can I ask?
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess if they appeal to the to MSRS first, and then do they get a chance to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings for another appeal if what you folks decide doesn't turn out?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, they would appeal to the board. We had it set up to go to a fact-finding conference. When we contacted the department and there didn't seem to be a question of or any evidence that he was contacted, there was really no purpose to go through a fact-finding conference at that point because there's nothing in anybody's records other than the deadline of 1999. So we can go through that fact-finding. It would then go to the board. After the board denies it, then they could go to the Court of Appeals. That would be the outcome.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, it's unfortunate there aren't any records, but all we know is that as far as, because we don't have any evidence that he was notified, therefore I think we need to assume he was not notified unless Mr. Bergstrom or Ms. Woja can produce something that says he was certified. So, I mean, Mr. Allness has been a fine public service, has been a fine state employee for all these years, and it's not a lot of money. Correction is not opposed to it. I don't see any point in continuing with Mr. Bergstrom's process when he's already indicated that that's likely not to happen because of the deadline. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move that House File 3606 be incorporated in the omnibus bill.
Senator Pappas, you've already moved it.
I've already moved it. Mm-hmm. I'll move it. I'll second my motion.
you strenuously.
I mean, I just think I'm not going to say anymore.
Representative Thiessen, did you have a question?
No, well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I don't know how typical this is, but if we are to move forward on this, is it possible to add another number under B describing the eligible person and having a finding that he didn't actually receive this notice so we can limit the precedential value of this case?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Thiessen's advice...
Representative Albright, one moment, please.
...should be well taken.
Ms. Lincheski, are you where Representative Thiessen was at? I mean, are you... Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that the two of you are still before you start getting additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, basically, to make it clear in the statutory language that we're making a finding here that he didn't receive the notice. I mean, and I wasn't probably paying enough attention. So the notice that would have gone to him would have been a certification. So they have to certify that he was working 75% time with inmates from 86 to 89. Mm-hmm. And was it part of the statute that he was supposed to get notice of that certification? Mm-hmm. I guess that's for Ms. Lincheski.
Yeah, Ms. Lincheski.
You know, I think it would be great to turn this one over to Mr. Bergstrom since you will definitely know
facts
Mr. are. Mr. Bergstrom, in the future, it might just be easy if you sat at the chair at the other end there.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll just sit here.
You're wearing the state carpet out there.
Until you tell me to leave.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, at the time, the way the process worked, the department was required to certify those who were eligible. And at that point, once they were certified, it was our responsibility to contact the member. Mm-hmm. So we never heard in this individual's case, as far as we can tell, from the department because of the 75% inmate contact. So we would get
it.
The department was supposed to certify, then we contacted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
And so there's no dispute from the department that he actually worked 75% time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that's my understanding, is that there is no dispute over that.
And Representative Thiessen, I think I would give the department the chance to be on the record with your question as well. Ms. Wojcik, if you'll identify yourself again, and then Representative Thiessen, if you want to ask the question for her again.
Mr. Chair, Lisa Wojcik, Assistant Commissioner from the Department of Corrections.
Thank you. So I guess the question was, there's no dispute from the department that he worked 75% time with inmates from 86 to 89.
Ms. Wojcik.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that's correct.
Okay. So thank you. I guess what I was suggesting is if we are going to move forward, we make it clear in the description of the eligible person that this is a situation where the department failed to notify MSRS that to do that certification of the time spent, and that MSRS as a result did not send notice that they otherwise would have sent. And maybe we need to work on the language before we...
If we're going to go there, we're going to have to lay this over.
To lay this over and come back.
At 7:03 on a Tuesday night.
That's
the very language.
What I would suggest... So that may be a way to kind of at least limit the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman.
I've got Ms. Lincheski, then Senator Pappas. Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only question, I guess, relating to that amendment, and it makes sense. My only question, though, is that I'm not sure that will stop the precedential effect of this, in that
from the sounds of it, it's possible that there are others that don't have the paperwork in the file, so it may not do that trick or you know, take care of that
Thiessen.
Problem.
You know, no, I thank you, Mr. Chair, and I agree with that. I don't know if it's exactly the way we should go, but I mean, if we are going to make a decision for, in this case, that failure is an error by the department, which is kind of how we do it. It'd be nice. I mean, you would do it in your memo in the future, I suppose, but it'd be nice to have it in the special law here too.
Senator Pappas, then Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say that I think that's a very good suggestion for an amendment, and I'm happy to support that.
Senator Goodwin.
You know, and Mr. Chair, I think we should add to that the department does certify that there 75% of the time was spent with inmates. Like, I think that'll also narrow it down some, so that they've already testified that 75% of the time was spent directly with inmates, because that'll cut down the number of possible other cases as well.
I see Ms. Lincheski taking notes if that's the route that we end up going. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, I've been on pensions for a while. I cannot remember the last time we heard of a situation where the person that is appealing is not a Minnesota resident. Do we see quite a few of these?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I'm not aware of when they come, where they live or not. So I can't answer that.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, in light of the conversation around the table and in light of the suggestion that this may be a precedent setting, I would move to lay this over.
If we are going to look at some language that it seems like members want to see, we don't have the ability to craft that. It's like I say, 7:07 on a Tuesday night. We will need to give staff adequate time to be able to prepare that. So I will lay over the amendment for possible inclusion at our next meeting. Mr. Bergstrom, I'm not going to have you go anywhere because our final item this evening is concerning you. Ms. Wolchek, thank you for your time this evening. Our final item is going to be item number 6, which is House File 3716. And members, what we're going to look at on House File 3716 is we're revisiting the Fairview Hospital privatization augmentation discussion that we've had. And we're simply going to get an update this evening from Mr. Bergstrom as to where we are at. There were some questions that we had last time this was before us. He's had a chance to pull some information together. He'd also like to have the chance to provide us some of the some information about how the augmentation works and some examples this evening. And then we did have two people who had asked to testify this evening. We will not be taking action on this matter this evening. And the only testimony that we will be taking later this evening would be anything that is new testimony that the commission has not heard. And I do not want to go back over topics that we've discussed already, because that's what Mr. Bergstrom is reporting on at this point. So, Mr. Bergstrom, if you will go ahead with your discussion and presentation this evening.
Mr. Chair, the last time you heard this bill, it faced considerable opposition. At the end of the discussion, you asked me to see if I could work with the parties to find some resolution. We did throw out a compromise, but all of the parties who we contacted did not feel comfortable talking about any alternatives until they had a chance to meet with others and hear and get an input from others. They didn't feel they represented enough people, and quite frankly, they didn't feel there was sufficient time to move forward this session. The other thing that I have... talking to the members and even questions that the commission has asked and others have, I would like to try to explain how deferred augmentation works in general and then explain how it works for Fairview, if you can indulge that for a little bit, just because I think there's so much sort of confusion about how this works.
Mr. Bergstrom, thank you for that. And there are documents that are coming around to members and also available to the public. Mr. Bergstrom, just to be able to make sure that we are on the same pages with you, would this be the document that says at the top what is deferred augmentation? That contains 4 pages of simple to read information.
Mr. Chair, nothing is simple, and I can see I'm clearing the room already. So it's so So that is correct. And so what I, on the first page, what I have is an example of someone, just a normal MSRS employee. And deferred augmentation is for someone who terminates employment but does not start collecting into the future. They either are not eligible or they want to leave their money in and collect at a later time. And what I'd like to do is just walk through this to kind of explain how it works. So if you look at the top, we have a high five salary of $33,000. And then at the time, we had a 1.5% per year of service formula. And I just took someone with 20 years of service. So if I take the 1.5% times 20, they get 30% of their high five salary. So you can see we take the high five, 3,333 times 30% to come up with $1,000 a month. So that's where we begin the process. We take the high five and their service credit to come up with a base benefit. And ironically, this came out exactly to $1,000 a month. So
magic.
Yeah. So that's our first part of our calculation. We then took a typical employee who retired on 12/31 of 96. And the chart says 97. At the time was age 40. It was at the time age 46. So what we do is we start with that $1,000 benefit. The first year until age 55, they get that benefit augmented by 3% each year. So the benefit grows to 1,030. The next year at 3%, it grows to 1,061. The next year at 3%, it grows at 1,093. At age 50, it would have grown to 1,126. So you can see as you move up, the benefit itself continues to grow. Then at age 55, now the augmentation increases to 5%. So now instead of growing at 3%, it grows at 5%, so it grows to 1305, to 1370, and up and down the line. Effective in 2011, we lowered the augmentation for all employees going forward to 2%. And you can see then that slowed the growth of the benefit. So if you just take the, sort of that growth process and see that it went up, the benefit that started at 1,000, assuming they had left the money in from age 46 to 65, their benefit, monthly benefit, would have grown to $1,893. Does that make sense so far? Because if it doesn't, then we're all in trouble. And I apologize. So that's a growth of the benefit. And then we start paying the $1,893. We go through the same process then on the next page with Fairview. So we took that exact same person, only made them a Fairview employee, where they now have enhanced augmentation. So you can see the calculation is the same. The high five salary of $3,333 times 30% starts with $1,000 a month. And then you watch the blue line grow. So the $1,000 benefit at 5% grows the first year to $1,055 instead of $1,030, the second year to $1,113, and it continues until age 55, at which point the augmentation increased to 7.5%. Then it accumulates at 7.5%, you know, to $1,741 to $1,870. Up until age 65, where now the benefit is $3,337. Process is exactly the same. The compounding of the benefits makes it grow more quickly. So we took that example to show what is happening at Fairview. We then changed the next page to a 59-year-old.
Mr. Bergstrom, before we go, maybe we just want to take member questions page by page on that, just so that we can stay with you on that. Members, questions on page 2. Mr. Bergstrom, I guess I just have one question. What we're seeing here is that using your example of $33.33 a month, the person at age 65 would have equally the same benefit of wage replacement that they had for salary while they were working. Am I reading that correct?
Mr. Chair, you would be reading that correctly based on the time. Now, they worked and got salary increases in between there, but if you go back to 96.
So there would be a 100% replacement in this example because of the enhanced augmentation.
Mr. Chair, correct. And this is just an example. It's not any individual. We just started with 1,000 because it was easier to do the math.
We know past performance is not indicative of future performance.
Right. And then, Mr. Chair, what we did is we took a 59-year-old because we wanted to get the impact of the change that we had. So in fairness, more than likely a 59-year-old today wouldn't have had as much service. So we started the benefit with fewer years of service, 15, and we started with a monthly benefit of $750. And so you can see we started on 2002 just because we can't fit the numbers in. By 2002, the benefit under Fairview had grown to $980 a month, and then we see the escalation from there. What you can see, the dotted blue line, is what our proposal would do if it went into effect as we had proposed. The benefit would still go up, but not as quickly going up. So what we're proposing at this point is that we continue to augment the benefit by 2% a year rather than the 7.5% a year. So what we're trying to show here is what the impact of this would be for people close to retirement. When we met last time, I think there was a lot of concern raised for somebody a year or two away from retirement. And you can see it does have an impact on them. So what the dotted line is to show the impact. So instead of growing to $3,210 in this example, now the benefit would grow to $2,602. A same typical employee covered by MSRS would be at $1,396. So just to kind of put it into comparison of where it would be.
Questions for Mr. Burks on page 3. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to figure out, okay, but what they have right now is what they were counting on, correct? I mean, if we make a change in this, they won't get what they were counting on towards retirement because they knew what they would probably get at retirement.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, that is correct. This would be lower than they were expecting at retirement.
Mr. Chair, that's
Senator
a
Goodwin.
Pretty harsh thing to do to people when they're close to retirement is to suddenly find out that they might have to work for many more years because they were counting on one amount and now they wouldn't get that amount, correct?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Bergstrom. Goodwin, I understand that, but on the same token, in 2010, we did exactly the same thing for all of our other members, and we made that change. So while I understand that, I also feel very strongly at some point this has to change because the growth continues if we don't. So you are absolutely right. And one of the proposals we threw out was to protect people closer to retirement so it wasn't so severe. But again, people felt that that would need a little more discussion.
Mr. Bergstrom, when you say that in 2010 that affected everyone in the MSRS plan, which these folks are a part of de facto because of the merger.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, as part of our balancing package in 2010, all of our MSRS members, which is the same plan these are in, saw their augmentation lowered.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Wasn't the issue then, correct me if I'm wrong, that they would just, but that their increase, their inflationary increase would be limited? That's the issue that brought them.
Mr. Chair,
Bergstrom.
Senator Goodwin, in this case, we're still proposing a 2% increase going forward. So we would give them exactly what we gave the employees when we passed the law in 2010.
Senator Goodwin.
Except, Mr. Chair, the ones close to retirement are expecting this amount. So if you changed it with this bill, would that change those retirement amounts for those people now?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Would reduce it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, it would not change anything anybody already retired. It would only
Right.
It would just,
I know that.
It would reduce the amount for people who have not yet retired.
So, Senator Goodwin, the way I understand this, Mr. Bergstrom, please correct me if I'm wrong, is let's say that this law went effective January 1st of 2017, and I was 64 and was going to retire at 65, I would have all of the previous accumulated augmented benefits on here, but then for that 1 year I would be at 2%. If I was 2 years away from retirement, I have all of that but the last 2 years. So it would be a time change. The closer I was to retirement, I'd be less affected by the change. If I was 45 and going to be retiring at 65, then I would have that time that you're talking about if I understand Mr. Bergstrom's proposal this evening correctly. Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, how many employees are we talking about in various ages?
Mr. Bergstrom.
And their various ages of retirement, too.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Burkett has the details.
Mr. Burkett, welcome, and state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Chad Burkett, Minnesota State Retirement System. Senator Rosen, I don't have the breakdown of their ages with me at the moment. I can certainly provide them for you. We're talking about a group of 1,280 people as of March 1st.
Mr. Burkett, could you state that number one more time? I didn't quite catch the...
Yeah, the size of the group is 1,280 people as of March 1st.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be interesting to know at what levels of... when are they going to retire of those 1,280, if we could at some point?
Other Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Burkett, out of those 1,280 people, how many people will continue at Fairview as it's being turned back into the University of Minnesota and whose salaries are going up as a result of that?
Mr. Burkett?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the number's in the 400 to 500 member range.
Representative Murphy, follow-up.
Oh.
Senator Goodwin.
I'm confused again. Mr. Chair, so first of all, I didn't know that Fairview was going back to be, or that University of Minnesota was taking over the hospital again. Is that the situation that's going on right now?
That's what I hear.
Oh, okay, so if they did, and there's 10 or 1,000 employees right now that are former U of M employees, why would there only be 500 if it converts back to the U of M? I don't understand that.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, the even employees who have left Fairview get this augmentation. So of the 1,200 roughly, 700 are no longer at Fairview. There are 500 at Fairview.
Oh.
So the 500 that are still employed at Fairview, if it does republicize instead of privatize, then that's a whole other discussion that we're going to have.
Members, to provide some clarity on this, I had a question on this today, and Ms. Gilbert is here to offer a little bit of background on what she found on this as well. Representative Thiessen.
Can I just follow up on that? So if it goes back to the University of Minnesota, under current law, all those people that are currently employees would lose their entire augmentation going back in history, right? That's how the statute's drafted?
Well, Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, I think they would lose it going forward.
But I thought the whole thing with the bill that Scott Dibble and I had was that if you reenter public service, you lose all of your augmentation going backwards.
No,
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, you lose the higher augmentation just going prospectively. Hmm. So somebody who returned to employment drops to 2%. So all of their augmentation would drop to 2%.
In the future.
Ms. Gilbert, I did catch you today, and we had a brief discussion on this, and I would just ask you to share with the commission the things that you had shared with me this morning or this afternoon we visited.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert, and I work with Fairview, and I can save this committee a lot of time. No hospital employee is going to be going back to the University of Minnesota. The merger is involving the University of Minnesota physicians, which never were university employees. So none of the merger discussion going on will have anything or any impact on the fund, other than the discussions that you have, which were, you know, previous university employees that are now Fairview employees, which you've discussed the two issues.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Mr. Bergstrom, I will ask if there's any other questions on page 3, then I know you have a final page of information you want to share with the commission. We'll move to page 4.
And Mr. Chair, on page 4, we have now someone who had only 5 years of service and is only 45 years old today. And with that, if they work another 20 years, we just want to depict how quickly that line goes up if we keep increasing their benefit by the current augmentation rates. And that is why I believe something really has to be done, because if it doesn't go unchecked, the 45-year-olds today, even though their benefits are smaller, they actually continue to grow at that higher rate, compounded at 5.5 or 7.5 going forward. And those are the ones, quite frankly, that end up being disproportionate, I think, from a benefit standpoint, more so than current or people really close to retirement. Just because you have more people. We have 99 members who are under age 46. So this, you know, we might not have the whole breakdown, but so there are quite a few Fairview, and granted their service is shorter. They probably have, you know, 5 or fewer years of service. Some may have a little bit more. But when you keep compounding that, you know, and that is really why our board wanted to bring this forward, is to at some point we have to stop this growth. And I understand it's taking away things, but we've done so to all of our members, and this is just going to keep growing and growing.
Mr. Bergstrom, please help me to check my understanding of this. An individual works in covered service for the enhanced augmentation, works there for a period of 5 years, separates at, say, age 45, using the number that you had. That individual could go into another profession, another career not covered by this plan, but yet still receive the 7.5%, even though they've separated employment?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
So an individual could then be starting another career, not public service, covered by one of our plans, maybe a private sector position, and know that they've got this ace in the hole, that as long as they don't apply for benefits with you, it grows at 7.5% a year, which, looking at the numbers, could be roughly 2/3 of what their salary was in replacement benefit, and they've worked 5 of the 25 years that that benefit was accruing. Would I be accurate in my assessment on that?
Mr. Chair, you would be.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the original memo, there were some numbers that were run on scenarios, and there were some people that actually whose benefit is less than they would have been had they stayed in public employment. One of the charts showed that there was and so how does that work in this context?
So, Mr. Chair, what we did is we took some actual cases and said, what if they had stayed covered by MSRS all of that time? In some of those cases, they would have gotten more contributing to MSRS. Some would have gotten less had they contributed to MSRS. But the difference is
they didn't contribute.
They didn't contribute all of those years. So, you know, when you factor in the contributions they would have paid for the 20 years, plus during that time, the hospital had a 403B and I think maybe another plan, they were contributing or had the potential to contribute to that as well.
Other questions for Mr. Bergstrom? I'm just going to ask you to stand by. We did have two people who had indicated that they have additional information, new information, for the Commission's consideration. And given the fact that we are coming close to the two-hour time frame that I have set, I'm going to allow each of them the opportunity to come down and share that new information with us. And members, we also have received some written information this evening that was not from an individual who was not able to be here. And I will draw your attention to that, and we will enter that into the public record as well. At this time, I'm going to ask the Stromquists to come down, as they have indicated they have additional new information that we did not know about at the time. And again, I'm going to keep it to new information that we haven't heard. I'm going to ask the testifiers to keep their comments succinct and on topic. Good evening, Mr. Stromquist. Good evening, Ms. Stromquist. Welcome to the Commission, and you do have some new information for us to consider as we're addressing and looking at this matter.
Thank you, Mr.
Stromquist. We're going to go first. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record, if you would, and then proceed with the new information.
Yes, I'm Daniel Stromquist.
And Gail Stromquist.
and I thank you for the opportunity to speak again. I don't mean to take much of your time here, but I've had the chance to review the tapes from 1996. And what I thought I would like to make sure that everybody understood, and from gathering from that, is that the bill itself that was written by our representative Phyllis Kahn, I think she testified at the last meeting, and I think there's nobody more qualified to testify on intent than the person that wrote and sponsored the bill himself. So I'd like to point out to the committee that on that tape, there was a lot of talk about actuarial assumptions. There were two actuaries, as you well know, or should know, and MSRS also commented on it. And what I gathered from that tape was this thing was already paid for. And so, in fact, there was a surplus of $128 million, and they actually had an amendment to absorb that $128 million. So it seems ironic to me that now they want to take a look at changing that plan to take away from what amounts to, it was about, I think it was 1,200, 1,300 people, and absorb $58 million. So if you do the math there, just in round figures, that's maybe $50,000 a piece. And so, but what really isn't spelled out, and what I don't think the committee really understands, is that it's not a straight $50,000 a piece for each person that's in the pension plan. Some people are going to lose $621,000, some people are going to lose $257,000, and some people zero. So I don't think it's equitable in terms of fairness. I don't think it's proper that somebody gets a 0% change and another person loses $620,000. I'd like to also comment on the handout from MSRS. And if you take a look at page 4, I believe it's page 4, was the example of a younger person that received a pension. And I believe they were 26 years old. And I'm here to tell you that nobody had a $250 pension at the age of 26. I can't say because I don't have the universe of knowledge, and I can't go look at the database and see what's in there. But I would say that it's unlikely, and maybe there's an example or two in there of someone that's going to get $2,434 a month for the rest of their life. I find that hard to believe. And also, I'd like to point out there that if you look at the top blue line and you look at the dotted blue line and you do the math there, what they're proposing, the cut they're proposing for this person is $336,000, and that's over 20 years. So I think that's a little absorbent. I think some people are going to get a 0% cut. I'd also like to point out on page 3, they're showing, if you turn to that page, they're showing another pension here, and this might be more of a normal example. And if you look at the green line, that assumes that a person didn't, I believe this is correct, I think it assumes that a person didn't have a raise for 20 years. Maybe they got a COLA adjustment or something. But to draw a line there and to make a comparison between the green line and the blue line on what this person would get, the $1,396 versus $3,210, I don't think that's a fair example here. And I just take exception to that. I guess what they're trying to say is that for some reason or another, it's the belief that these augmented people are getting this tremendous pension. I don't think that's true at all. I think if you take a look at what they intended when they wrote that, and they knew exactly what the numbers were, the actuaries that ran the numbers, there was not this
Mr.
tremendous
Strongquist,
pension.
I I've let you go for about 6 minutes, and now I kind of remember in the back of my mind hearing some of the things that you're talking about at this point that I just want to, again, keep it to some of the information that is truly new information for us to consider.
Okay. Pardon me? Okay. I guess my point is taking a look at this, it's obvious that this thing needs more study. I don't think the numbers are correct. I don't think you're getting the full picture here. I really don't think you know a good enough fact pattern to decide on this thing and to vote on this thing. And I guess I would ask that it not be included in the pension bill until we've got a real handle on the thing. And yes, I'd like to rehash the old information because I think it's important. I don't think it's out there. I don't think it's been properly disclosed. In my handout, which I won't go over here, kind of says some of these things. I think there's some legal issues here that need to be dealt with. And in my paperwork there, you can take a look at that on your own time. So that's all I had really to say here.
Thank you, Mr. Stromquist.
Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you, sir. Ms. Stromquist, is there anything you personally wanted to add as we had you up there as well this evening?
No.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
And the other testifier who's asked is Rena Garney, if I pronounced that correctly. And we'll ask you again to come up and share the new information that you have for our consideration on the matter that's before us. Good evening and welcome. So just state your name for the record and then proceed.
My name's Rena Garney, and I'm with Fairview Health Services.
Move the mic over.
Ms. Garney, we're just going to ask you to pull that microphone a little bit closer because we can't hear you, and we got to get you on the record as well with your testimony. Thank you.
My name is Rena Garney, and I work for Fairview Health Services. I started at the university and then was one of those employees that transitioned. And I wasn't able to make the last meeting, so I listened to the tapes. And on the tapes, I believe somebody had mentioned in that they wanted to know if anybody had read the documentation back from 1996 and listened to the tapes. It appears that nobody had the opportunity. So with the help of the Pension Commission staff, I was able to obtain the documentation and listen to the tapes, which are very interesting, I must say. And I fully encourage you to do so if you have time, because they talked at great length about why and were concerned about the augmentation rates. And I think they did a very good job of it, and I was very thrilled years later now to know that people were concerned about us. Now, there is not anything new today that they didn't know back then. And in the documents that were presented to the commission, there were a report that from two actuaries that were done. One was hired by, I believe, MSRS Mercier. Did I pronounce them right?
Yes, Mercier.
And then the University of Minnesota hired a Deloitte and Touche. And in there, they gave the information. And one of the sentences I would like to read to you is, please note that under the most generous change, which was number 4, and that provided the increased augmentation rates, MSRS still receives a windfall gain, which has the effect of reducing actuarial contribution requirements in future years. And then Mercier said already, Deloitte and Touche said Mercier already had the programming availability due to their current relationship with MSRS. So it points out right there that they believed moving forward everything would be fully funded. And then the next, and this information was available in the documentation that the commission received at that time. and I believe you worked with them. Okay. And then another piece of information that I would like to draw your attention to was MSRS handed out information to us enrollees that transitioned, and they said you have two choices with regard to your retirement account. You may leave your retirement deductions with MSRS and receive a lifetime monthly annuity when you retire, or you may apply for a refund of those deductions following termination of university employment. And then it goes down further in the page and explains the special augmentation rate. And then they MSRS mails out a messenger. It's a newsletter that they provide throughout the year. And in the winter of 2015, that was just a few months ago, their headlines state, General Plan, which is the one we're talking about right now, reaches 92% funded. So we're still in the general plan. And according to this newsletter, it's 92% funded, which is very good if you consider what's happening nationally. And then the last piece of documentation I'd like to show you or tell you about is at the Board of Regents meeting in July 11th of 1996, there was a note on our benefits and the pension. It said, Minnesota legislature amended the Minnesota State Retirement System plan to replace nearly all loss benefits for university employees who transfer to Fairview. To be eligible for the amended plan, an employee must be employed on the day before the transfer effective date and paid on a biweekly payroll basis. And it goes on to explain the increase augmentation in our annuity and Rule 90. So back then at that time, this was all known. And they calculated out what people would get. So this is not new information. And so at that time, they realized that they're giving us the special augmentation, as Representative Kahn testified, to try to make us whole. And it was meant to be permanent. Now, I'd like to share briefly a personal aspect, because I'm within 5 years of retirement. And the proposed change, as it stands right now, my annuity would be reduced $640 a month. That's almost what I pay in rent right now. I pay $820 in rent on a monthly basis. And that's a big hit. Over the years, I have gone to financial planners trying to make sure that I would have enough put away. And I would bring in the statement. It was an old statement because MSRS would mail out, this is back in, right after the merge, like in 1997 or 1998, they mailed out a statement telling us what we would get on a monthly basis for our annuity. And so like 15 years ago, my financial advisor said, well, go back and ask for another one. I said, it's not going to change. And they said, I still want you to go back. And I said, okay. So I called and they told me on the phone that's not going to change. And I said, can I speak to an actuary? And so they had me speak to one. And I explained the situation. And the lady was professional, but she was very perturbed with me. And she said, tell them this will not change. And then she goes on and on about
how much our benefits are better than the others. And I said, you know, I understand that, but we were given it for a reason. And I just have to make sure it's not going to change because my financial planner really wants to know. And after that, I told her I'm not going to, my financial planner is a lady, and I told her, I do not want to go back again and ask them because they were not happy with me at the, you know, this past, you know, month that I did. And she said, okay. So we planned on that based on those numbers. And if I know somebody had proposed maybe changing it to like 65 or something like that and then changing the augmentation rate, and if we do that, that's like what I pay in grocery bills each month that I would lose. I think we've been able to show you between the different people that have testified that it is a permit, it was meant to be permanent. And I don't feel that it's fairness that you compare us with the regular people that get the 2%. We were given that additional amount for a special reason. And bottom line, there's no new information today that people didn't have back then. And that's about all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
Ms. Garney, thank you for your testimony this evening. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a note of this, and I know it doesn't really help the MSRS bottom line, but I think it's important to include this information that in this letter we got from this medical technologist in the clinical chemistry lab who's been there since 1974. She makes note that she lost 2 days of annual PTO and company paid legal holidays after Fairview recalibrated their benefits to conform to its system, that her medical insurance went up more than four times from its cost at the U of M, and she was forced to change providers. And the medical leave that she'd accumulated during 21 years at the U of M was altered, so that is almost impossible to use unless you're completely debilitated by cancer or some other disease. And it took her 4 years for her compensation from Fairview to recover to the level it had been with the U of M. So that's kind of a lot of losses. I think one way this is different than, for example, the rest of us being limited to 2% increases, is that these employees went from a government entity, from a higher education entity, public school, to a private hospital, and they obviously lost some benefits and salary, and I think somehow that should be figured into their losses. I'm just saying that it all added up to less money and less time off at the time. So, and now too, I suppose, for all these years.
Mr. Bergstrom, I think we're going to give you the last word on the topic this evening for us.
So, Mr. Chair, first of all, I was just trying to give an example. I wasn't giving any specific, and I think I made that clear. But I think where you can argue over numbers and examples, I think the green line difference and the blue line difference is real. I will tell you that we did do the actuarial numbers. At that time, we were 107% funded, and a lot has changed since then. And we are in a different world. We have reduced the benefit for all of our members, deferred members, to 2%. We've lowered COLAs. We've increased contributions. We've tightened down. We've lowered the investment assumption. We're changing the mortality. The intent, in my mind, of the law was to provide benefits when you add MSRS benefits, when you add it to what they have from the hospital, akin to what they would have been had they stayed in MSRS. And I am fairly confident for almost everybody we have done more than that when you add the two together. And I am especially concerned if this goes sort of untethered for 20 more years. I really think you're going to have situations where people's benefits are nowhere equal to what was intended. And I think the intent of the law, I talked about it last time, I don't have it in front of me, it was to sort of, kind of give them their contribution equality. And we've more than done that. So I understand this is a difficult situation. I think there are ways to protect those people who are close to retirement.
You know, we did throw out a proposal that would have protected essentially anybody over 60, so that they would not have seen a loss. There are ways to do this, but I think if we continue to let this grow, these folks, you know, are going to get a benefit higher than anybody else, have paid less than most people, and quite frankly, I've broken promises to every member of our plan. And I've cut COLAs, or proposed COLAs, I proposed lower augmentation, and, you know, and quite frankly, I helped create this. And I think it's done more than what we did. I think we met their needs, and I just think at some point this has to be resolved. Otherwise, I think it's going to grow to a very disproportionate amount.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. With that, we are adjourned.
If I put stuff in my space, I ought to save it. Absolutely. Thank you.